Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Daniel Reiche and Tamer Sorek, editors of their new book, Sport, Politics, and Society in the Middle East. It's a pleasure to have you both for the program. Welcome, Daniel Reiche and Tamer Sorek.
Yes, thank you, James, for including us in your excellent program.
Thank you, James.
My pleasure. Maybe we can start off with Daniel first, maybe, and then Tariq, telling us a little bit about what your intellectual history is, if you wish, and how that intellectual history brought you to editing this volume, as well as earlier books that each of you have written independently on sports in the Middle East.
Okay, so different to Tamir, who did already his PhD on sports, as he might explain in a minute, all my degree work was on energy and environmental policy in a comparative perspective. And my specific interest was on policies for the promotion of renewable energies. However, once I became a professor, I started to develop a class on the politics of sports. And one of the reasons for my interest was that after moving to Beirut in 2008 to become an assistant professor at that time at the American University of Beirut, I realized how much sport and politics are mixing in Lebanon. And I worked on a first case study and article titled War Minus the Shooting, the Politics of Sport in Lebanon, where I showed that all the major football and basketball clubs have political and even religious affiliations. So with this article, who has been published in Third World Quarterly, my intellectual journey in the field of sports started, and I have published a number of articles since then. I published in 2016 a book with Routledge on success and failure of countries at the Olympic Games, where I specifically looked at government policies to achieve sporting success in the Olympics. And now I've edited with Tamir the book Sport, Politics, and Society in the Middle East, which we will discuss later on.
And Tamir, this has been sort of the outset of your career.
I was a graduate student in sociology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in the mid-90s. And it was the time when, for the first time, an Arab team made it to the top Israeli division in soccer. So I became curious about this phenomenon, and I decided to look closely. I counted how many Arab teams are represented in the various Israeli leagues. And I found out that there are 42% of the teams, while there are only 17% of the citizens. So in that moment, I felt like there is something much deeper to investigate here. And this moment was the departure to my dissertation about Arab soccer in Israel, which later developed into my first published book. Later in my career, I tried to take another direction. I studied the Palestinian commemoration in Israel. Recently, I published a biography of the Palestinian poet Tawfiq Zayad. But what happened is that I became known as this specialist of sports in the Middle East. And back then, 20 years ago, it was not a common phenomenon of scholars writing about sports in the Middle East. So I was dragged by other scholars to continue and work on it. And I found frequently that I enjoyed. So I published other articles about sports, about boxing, in Arab boxing in Israel, and about the internal Jewish ethnic tensions in Israel and soccer. And in 2017, Daniel and I, we were invited to the workshop in Qatar by Georgetown University in Doha. And the topic of the sports was of the workshop was sports in the Middle East. They invited scholars who specialize in different countries and in different disciplines. And this was the background for the edited volume that we were asked to edit following this workshop. Unlike Daniel, I made the other way around. I started in sports. I tried to leave the field, but it's in a way, it's addictive. There is something so dramatic and emotional about this field of sport that I think I will continue to find myself writing on it in one way or another for the rest of my career.
Well, you've actually touched on something which is, I think, important in terms of the book, in terms of the background to the book, if you wish, and that is that Middle Eastern studies really was the one area of geographic or area studies globally, which almost neglected up until, 15, 20 years ago, and maybe even less, almost neglected the sports aspect of the region. And I'm wondering why that is, if you have a sense of why that is. It's now something that's starting to grow, and you see more people doing dissertations and publishing on it, but it really took a very long time.
That's right. And I believe one of the reasons why there's no so much interest in sport in the Middle East are the Gulf countries and their investments into sports. Now, it made the headlines that Saudi Arabia is interested in buying an English Premier League club, Newcastle United. If they are allowed to do so, they would do something that Qatar already started 25 years ago. In 1993, they hosted the first ATP tennis tournament with the German Boris Becker. I have to mention this since I'm German, winning the tournament. And so Qatar has hosted many, 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 many sporting events. So hosting the FIFA World Cup 2022, which draws now a lot of attention, but it's more, it's not like the beginning of a journey. It's like part of a process that started in the early 90s with like hosting annual sporting events, which hosting like continental and global championships. That's one. Second is that some Gulf countries heavily invested into global sports. I mean, the most prominent examples are Qatar by its investment fund, owning Paris Saint-Germain and Abu Dhabi, Manchester City. But most remarkable are the sponsorships all over the world by Middle Eastern airlines like Emirates and Qatar Airways, who sponsor so many clubs all over the world. maybe the most difficult part is to achieve own sporting success. Here is still a lot to do. Qatar has invested in this world-class facility, the Aspire Academy, which trains local talent. But I think that's the main reason why we have so much interest in the Middle East now, because the Gulf countries, but also Turkey, they hosted, they belong in sport not to Asia like the Gulf countries, they belong to Europe. And they hosted, for example, the Champions League final in 2005, but many, many other sporting events as well. They unsuccessfully were bidding for a number of Summer Olympic Games. So what we witness is that centers and peripheries in global sports are changing. The center in soccer used to be Europe and South America. In Olympic sport, it used to be Europe and North America and a bit Southeast Asia. And now we have a former periphery moving to the center, which is a parts of the Middle East who become pretty successful in hosting events, but also in, for example, there is an international headquarter of the International Cricket Association in the UAE. So on many levels, Middle Eastern countries, and particularly the Gulf countries and Turkey, moved from the periphery to the center in global sports.
Tama, before you add on to this, let me just ask you something very specifically, which is that if you look at Israeli scholarship, that was one of the very few exceptions, I think, in Middle East, in scholarship on the Middle East and scholarship in the Middle East, that quite early on focused on sports and the relationships that sports has in society and politics. And there are a fair number of Israeli scholars who've been dealing, like you, with this for quite some time. I wonder why that is.
Well, I think we should frame the discussion in the broader issue of the sociology of knowledge in the Middle East. And then we can talk about the particular Israeli case. I think historically, not only in the study of the Middle East, but this academic study of sport has been marginal in the academic world. It is because it is considered to be part of leisure, not of work, which is the serious issue that scholars should work on. It is considered a field, a childish field, because it is by playing, it is a game. It has taken a while for scholarship generally to take sport seriously. So we begin from a position of marginality. Now, add to that the traditional study of the Middle East by the West, which was based originally on Orientalist perspective in anthropology, also in history, aimed at creating, defining the Middle East as traditional, as backward. Bringing into this discussion modern sports did not fit this epistemological framework. So you take the marginality of sports in general, and you take this Orientalist look at the Middle East, and you can understand why there were no studies of sports by Western scholars. And when we talk about academic scholarship, usually we refer to the center of power, Western Europe and the United States. Now, when since the late 70s, there are more and more studies of the Middle East in the West, which have attempted to take a distance from this Orientalist framework, they wanted to establish themselves as serious scholarship, and they were very careful not to be associated with the marginal field of sports. So you have a delay of, I think, two decades between the emergence, or at least the acceleration of non-Orientalist studies of the Middle East, and the moment when scholars of the Middle East said also, sports is also part, an important part of the history of society of the Middle East, and it makes sense to pay attention to it. I think it's a question of how confident you are in your position as in the map of academic scholarship. So Israel is a little bit different here because Israeli scholars did not see themselves part of the Middle East in many ways. And also, if you take myself, for example, I was close to the field of the Middle East and the sport of the Middle East, but I've been privileged enough to have the self-confidence to start to study something that everyone considered marginal. I must say that even though you mentioned that Israeli scholarship of sport emerged relatively early, and you, I agree with you, but even in this case, it was late. My PhD was the first PhD in the sociology of sport in Israel at the time, and I started to work on it in the late 90s. The book of Amir Ben Porat about Hapoel Taibe also was published during the same time. Previously, there were very few articles on sports in Israel. So the Israeli case is slightly earlier, but not much earlier than the study of sports in other areas of the Middle East. What happened in the last two decades, and I think indirectly Daniel referred to it earlier, is when it turned out that a sport is a huge business in the Middle East, it enabled more scholarly attention from Western scholars. So half of the articles, half of the chapters in our book, they're coming from fields of business and management, and it is partly related to this economic development.
Actually, there's one other major exception, I think, and that's Algeria going back to the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s as a result of the Algerian liberation struggle, which takes me really to my first question directly related to your book, and that is that a dominant underlying theme seems to be the relationship of politics and sports. And I was wondering, if you were to take a bird's eye view of the last century, what trends do you see that persistently over time cut across national borders? And maybe, I don't know, Daniel, do you want to take a first stab and then?
Yeah, I think while it might be boring to quote something, but I would like to do it at this point, because I think what is summarizing quite well our thoughts are two of the last sentences in the introduction, which state, "The common thread in this volume is that sports in the Middle East are much more than an interesting angle through which to popularize academic themes. They are themselves a major political and economic force that not only reflect but also shape both individuals' lives and large-scale social processes."
Tamer, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I think something that is both common to Middle East countries, and in a way distinguish them from the development in the United States and in Europe, is that sport has been a representation of Western institutions in the Middle East. And by being a representative of the West, they became a point of struggle, a point of contention. When local elite sometimes try to modernize their society, and I'm saying modernize in quote because it was based on a certain conception of modernity. For them, modernization meant westernization. They wanted to develop their, westernized elites wanted to modernize their society based on the model of Western modernity, and sport has been a tool for them to achieve that. More recently, you see, I think you can see it from an early stage when some elements in their society, exactly because sport was Western, developed some objection to this. It's not particularly to the idea of physical activity, but to particular Western sports. You can see, for example, when Islamist political movement emerged, they saw Western sport as part of the problem and criticized it. in the long term, what we see is that even these Islamist political movements had to concede and basically try to include Western sports instead of fighting it, trying to use the popular power or the power of sports to mobilize people in order to promote their own agenda, and they stopped fighting it. Another tension that you might see, and you can, I think the chapter of Murat Yildiz in the book discuss it, is the tension between seeing sports as fun and sports as a disciplinary tool, sports as a tool that can develop certain traits of the self, such as self-discipline, that might benefit for society. So this is another tension that you see, particularly in Middle Eastern sport. And both of them are related in a way to the colonial domination of the Middle East. Because for, and this is well documented in certain countries, especially the British thought that sports might be a way for them to co-opt the local elite. You can also see it in the case of Israel in its relation to the Palestinian citizens of Israel. There was certainly a certain conscious efforts by the state to co-opt the local elite by using sports. And what we see, again, in the long term, that these same attempts to use sports to control were turned upside down, where the indigenous people of the Middle East adopted it and used it as a stage for anti-colonial protest and sometimes protest against the state itself.
You know, what struck me as I read the various contributions to the book was that in terms of what we're talking about, there seemed to be two countervailing trends that emerged. One was top-down, with political elites seeing sports and particularly football as a means to project identity, foster attitudes conducive to creating a defense force, garner soft power. The other is bottom-up, using sports as a vehicle for resistance against colonial power post-independence state power, assertion of identity, and the fight for a whole array of rights, whether human, ethnic, religious, women, or national. Would you agree with that sort of reading or assessment?
Yes, I think that's an excellent summary, James. We have bottom-up processes like in Jordan, where football is maybe the only arena where Palestinians can express a sense of Palestinianness by supporting the Wehdat football club, who is, by the way, pretty successful. There are no other opportunities for Palestinians in Jordan. It's not, Palestinian history is not taught in schools. There are no like museums of Palestinian history and so on. So the stadium became only, maybe the only arena where they can express sense of Palestinianist. I mean, Tamir can later on talk about his contribution on the Hapoel Tel Aviv fans, because here we have a bit of a similar case where secular liberalism in Israel is, that's his argument, in crisis, but by supporting this club, it's also a way to express a sense of Israeliness that it's that is different from like what is mainstream at the moment in the country. So yes, so this applies to the bottom-up processes. But you are totally right, James. The state plays a major role in many Middle Eastern countries when it comes to sports, and particularly when we look at those countries that have heavily invested into sports, like the Gulf countries, Turkey. But we can also see the limits of such a top-down approach. I mean, in Turkey, billions of dollars have been invested to build new stadiums. But when it comes to sport participation, it's still quite low. The author of our chapter on Turkey, Professor Cem Tinas from Istanbul Bilgi University, he is not only a professor for sport management, but also a member of the Turkish Tennis Federation, board, and he writes that there are less than 5,000 people playing tennis in Turkey. That's a country of 80 million people. So, and we have in the Gulf countries the problem that on the one hand, the countries heavily invest into football, but on the other hand, they have to realize that it's very difficult to change attitudes of the population overnight. So if we look at Qatar, for example, it's a pretty academically oriented society. And so there is many families do not consider it as valuable to aim for a sporting career. And it's even worse when it comes to women. I mean, we have a chapter on female football in Qatar. And we can see here it's happening, but it's only happening in environments where no men are present. And when the national Qatari women's football team is not active at the moment, you know, they're not even listed in the FIFA world ranking. And if a country is not listed, it means it has been inactive for more than 18 months. I know myself, I once interviewed a former coach of the Qatar national women's football team. And she said to me, it was really frustrating. She went to the schools, she looked the girls playing, and many talented girls were there. But when she would invite them to the practice of the national team, the families would not allow it because they would know if a girl plays in the national team, this would involve male audiences, broadcasting on TV, etc. And that's something that is at this point not accepted to concur with the values of the country. So here we can see the limits of such a top-down approach. So it might work to purchase a major football clubs abroad. It might work to stage mega sporting events. Activating the population to practice sport and particularly for women to allow a higher sporting participation remain quite difficult challenges.
I think in the case of women participation, at least in the chapters that we present in the book, we see that without pressure from the bottom, without the insistence of women to take things into their hand, to enter the field, to participate, it won't happen. We did not see much support from the state, from the policy. And even when it happens, it's sometimes in answer to some external pressure and not a comprehensive policy of the state, like we can see when states like Turkey decides to invest in building stadiums, they do it with lots of enthusiasm. So, especially in the case of women participation, this is something that really comes. It is more a grassroots movement than a result of a policy. If you agree, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, Turkey and Lebanon are a bit outliers. When they send delegations to the Olympics, usually half of the delegations are women. I totally concur with what you said on the external pressure. When Saudi Arabia sent for the first time in 2012 women to the Olympic Games, it was only because International Olympic Committee, IOC, threatens that they might be expelled from the Olympics if they don't start sending women to the Olympics. I mean, needless to say that this was rather symbolic, and the women in the Saudi Arabia team was an expat from the US. So here we can see that it needs both. If you don't have a combination of a top-down support and a bottom-up developments, then there is a failure. And maybe this is the largest challenge in most, not all countries of the Middle East. There are some exceptions, Israel, Lebanon, Turkey. But for most countries in the Middle East, the biggest challenge in sport is promotion of female sporting participation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sticking for a moment still with the role of the state, it also strikes me, and maybe you can talk a little bit about this, that, you know, this relationship that you see in particularly in the Middle East between sports and politics, on how that has shaped sports and sports governance in the Middle East. Tamer, do you want to go first?
Could you please repeat?
My question was basically, you have this very almost incestuous relationship between sports and politics in the Middle East. And so the question is, how has that shaped sports on the one hand? And on the other hand, how has it shaped sports governance in the region?
As you say, the relations are very complicated, and I think here the particular partners are they are context dependent. I will take from the example that where I know the most, which is in Israel, that the Palestinian infrastructure of sports was completely destroyed in 1948 when the urban city of modern Palestine were destroyed in Jaffa, in Haifa. And after the war, the Israeli military regime that was imposed on the Arab citizens of Israel wanted to use sports as a tool to co-opt and discipline the Palestinian citizens of Israel. So there was a particular political goal, and sports has been a tool. And but what happened in the long term is that gradually, and this is something that we can see maybe the peak of the process only in recent years, Palestinian fans adopted sports not only as a way to become Israelis, but as a form of political protest against the state. Now, this transition from sports as a disciplinary tool is something that we could see also in other contexts. James, you mentioned earlier Algeria. In Algeria also, you had Algerian players in the French national team when Algeria was an integral part of France. But one of them, Rachid Mekloufi, organized the other players to establish the team of the FLN that became a symbol of anti-colonial resistance during the Algerian war. And here you can see here another example how the original political goal that was assigned to sport was turned upside down. You can see in the history of Egypt also, like the club of Azamalek that was the first sport club in Cairo. It originally was populated by a westernized elite, certainly not a bastion of national anti-colonial project, but with the emergence of the competition with Al-Ahli, Al-Ahli became, with the years, a bastion of nationalism. And you could see how in the Arab Spring, not only a nationalism, but also a protest against the government that many in Egypt saw as not a government that is representing the people. And Al-Ahli became both the representation of the struggle, but also practically they provided a stage for presenting the protests, and also the Ultras fans had experience with confronting the police. And therefore they could guide other protesters during the Arab Spring. A similar phenomenon even happened in Turkey, where the hardcore fans of certain Istanbulian teams were leading the Gazi protest several years ago against neoliberalism in the country. So there is a constant tension in the Middle Eastern countries between sports being a possible tool for the authorities, either previously colonial authorities, but in modern days, the state authorities, and it also has the potential to be a tool of protest, of anti-establishment trends in society.
In the introduction that both of you co-authored, you draw a distinction between strong and weak states and suggest that part of the solution in strong states is greater private sector involvement, while corruption is the major issue in weak states. The question is, isn't corruption, whether political, financial, or in sports performance, an issue across the Middle East and North Africa, irrespective of the nature of the state?
Yes, that's true. And I mean, we just need to look at international indexes of corruption, where Middle Eastern countries are usually not ranked well. But I think the argument we wanted to make is that there are some countries where the entire sports sector is totally state-driven and state-dominated. If we look at Qatar, for example, all the clubs in the Qatar Stars League, in the Professional Football League, they're all government-owned. And we can also see in Turkey, for example, where there was now a big program of building new stadiums financed by the government. So here, these countries have the challenge of having more private involvement in the sports sector. We have in the weak countries like Lebanon the opposite. The government fails in properly supporting the sports system. And what only works is private initiative. We can see that athletes who compete for a country like Lebanon, the Olympics, are usually upper class, because the parents do the job that the state should do by like promoting the sporting career of their children. And if we look at sporting events in Lebanon, a big success is the Beirut Marathon. This is privately organized. It's a big success. People from all over the world go there to participate. It's, by the way, also very inclusive, because it goes through different neighborhoods, the difference to the marathon in Jerusalem, for example. So that's a great event, but it's privately organized. So the relationship of the state and the society is quite different from country to country. We see a strong state involvement in the Gulf and in Turkey, and we see more reliance on the private sector in weaker countries such as Lebanon.
Tamer, do you want to add anything?
Well, I'm not familiar enough with the field of corruption, so I will leave the expertise of Daniel to speak here.
If I may, Daniel, coming back to the issue of the private sector, I mean, as you said very early on in this conversation, Lebanon is sort of an odd man out in the Middle East. I mean, what you more generally see, and you certainly see that in the Gulf, that the private sector is hardly independent and almost singularly dependent on the state. And so the question is whether, if you were to start trying to motivate the private sector to become more involved and to play a role at a more independent contribution, then you're really talking about structural reform, you know, the kind of reform that the Gulf has been talking about and other Arab states have been talking about for a very long time, but have yet to implement.
Yes, that's true.
Going further, you know, in the chapter on Turkey, which Cem Tinaz wrote, He discusses the promotion of elite sports and the pursuit of mega event hosting rights in a bid to enhance Turkey's international prestige and polish its image tarnished by human rights abuse and regional military adventure at the expense of stimulating the development of grassroots. Would you say that's an example of the problems that are involved in what is essentially an unregulated relationship between sports and politics? And if not, what would you suggest that Cem's chapter represents?
No, the argument from Cem, who interviewed several former ministers of sport and who looked at the time of since the AKP is governing Turkey, which started in 2002. So he's looking since 2002, and the chapter relies on interviews with former ministers of sport. And the argument he makes is that there is too much focus on hosting mega sporting events and on building stadiums rather than on supporting grassroots sports. And I already presented the example of tennis with less than 5,000 people playing tennis, but even in the national sport of soccer, we can see that in the national team there are always many diaspora players from Germany, for example. And so Turkey is not doing well in supporting grassroots sports. And Cem argues that maybe the biggest failure is when it comes to the education system and to include the promotion of sport into the education systems. So that's the main argument of the chapter. So here we can see that Turkey mainly uses sport for foreign policy purposes and to give pride to the population by giving them the impression that the country would return to like a former greatness. But on the ground, when it comes to grassroots sports, the country is far behind.
And I believe what Daniel mentioned about Turkey here, it's coming to other countries in the Middle East. Actually, in the chapters in our books, there is no single case, any evidence that a country is investing significantly in grassroots sports. Most of the support comes exactly for this purpose, to provide a symbolic pride, symbolic collective pride for the citizens of the state and to increase the international stature of a country, but certainly not a serious investment in grassroots sports.
Yeah, so the Middle East is kind of the opposite to Scandinavia. Scandinavia doesn't really care about hosting major events, doesn't really care about like big successes in the Olympics. So most Scandinavian countries won most of their medals in the first part of the 20th century, but they really want to support grassroots sports. That's what matters for them. And here we see the opposite, that we have mainly foreign policy goals and contribution to like national pride, etc. But what should be always at the forefront of each sport policy to support that every human being can practice the sport he or she wants to practice? There is still a lot to do in the entire region.
And I have to say something here. I have concern that the growing power of the private sector will not solve this problem. The private sector is interested in consumption, not in practicing by itself. Sometimes they can come together, but not necessarily. So I do not see that the development or the private sector will solve this problem.
Yeah, it's necessary to have more private involvement, but the state, of course, remains the key. What happens when the private sector plays a key role, we can also see in Lebanon in soccer, where we have now a lot of private academies, but it costs like $100 to subscribe a kid in such an academy. And that's in a country with an average income of $1,000 per month. So here, the entire class composition of the sport is now changing from from a lower middle to a middle upper class sport. So I concur with Tamir. So the role of the state is very important to make sure that sport is integrated into the education system, that there are enough facilities available, that there are good coaches, and so on. However, of course, the best combination is of strategic planning by the state, plus like bottom-up initiatives in society to have a proper functioning sporting sector.
I wonder, Daniel, whether to some degree, irrespective of how successful Qatar may be an exception to the rule, because there you've had really an effort to make sports part of national identity. You have a national sports day and various other things, whether there's at least not been a nominal attempt to try and get a grassroots, a more popular buy-in into it.
Yes, I think Qatar is doing pretty well. Sport has become a national priority. This National Sports Day that you mentioned is one example. And a lot of facilities have been created. Foreign coaches with a lot of expertise have come to Qatar to work there. Certainly, one of the major issues, there are two major issues in Qatar. One is to encourage women and girls, and to also that there is acceptance by their families when, you know, they play football, for example. So here we can see that you can invest overnight a lot and have a lot of like successes and changes overnight when it comes to infrastructure, for example, to hosting events. But to change a culture, it might take a generation. So the gender issue is one. And the second issue is of course, the involvement of all the expats in the country, because around 90% of the people living in Qatar do not have a Qatari passport. And I believe that the restrictive citizenship law is limiting the potential of the country in sports. Yes, if somebody is like really good in sport, he or she is naturalized. But in the long run, I think if there would be a path towards long-term residence, a path towards citizenship for all the migrants living and working in Qatar, I think also the sports sector would benefit from such a liberalization of the nationality law.
Tama, the relationship between sports and politics also comes back in Doug Tuastad's chapter on how the football pitch offers a platform for battles of identity in Jordan, as expressed in the memories, or as in the memories in the case of El Wajad, the Palestinian club. It also comes back in the chants of supporters and what that reflects in your chapter about Hapoel Tel Aviv. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when we talk about a national identity, in every country, national identity is a contested terrain where you have different parts of society, different parties, different sectors, trying to shape the collective national identity to fit their own ideology, their own interest. And because of the dramatic aura of sports, and especially soccer in these countries, you can see one major expression of the fight over collective identity in this field, in this stadium. So both in Israel and in Jordan, you have these two examples. So in Jordan, part of the population, most likely the majority. We don't know because there hasn't been any census. Most of the population is Palestinian. Power, however, is in the hand of the original inhabitants of Jordan, who are not Palestinians, and Palestinian national identity is not legitimate in the Jordanian public sphere. Palestinians in Jordan found the stadium, the soccer stadium, as a place where they can present, where they can display their collective national aspiration, their collective national identity, Palestinian national symbols, the Palestinian national flag, Palestinian anthem. This is the place where it was, even if not accepted by the state, they had to tolerate it. Sometimes they didn't, but sometimes they faced the backlash from fans, Jordanian fans, who did not like the idea of Palestinian national identity in Jordan. And I remind you that in 1970, there was actually a civil war there between these two elements in Jordan. So this is, there is a lot of blood memory in the field when these two identities are coming into conflict. The chapter I contributed to the volume about Israeli national identity describe the tension between the primordial Jewish code of national identity. In a way, it is compatible with the original goal of Zionism to establish a Jewish ethnic state in Palestine. And the extreme form of that is the demography of Beitar Jerusalem, a team that never hired an Arab player, a team that whenever the managers or the owners over the past decades announced their willingness to hire an Arab player, the fans rebelled against it. So here you have Beitar that is very exclusive toward Arab fans and toward Arab players. On the other edge of this political spectrum, you have Hapoel Tel Aviv, a team that traditionally accepted Arab players since the mid-1970s. It does not mean that Hapoel Tel Aviv is not part of the Zionist project. It is certainly part of the original, of the Labor Party that led the Zionist project. Actually, even the stadium of Hapoel Tel Aviv, Bloomfield, is located on the same spot of Al-Basra Stadium that was the major Palestinian sports stadium before 1948. It replaced it. It came on the ruins of the Palestinian sport infrastructure. However, since the team started to include Arab players in the mid-70s and gradually the fans adopted this inclusiveness as part of their identity, and they are proud of the fact that they were the first Arab, the first Jewish team to have an Arab captain, they used this inclusiveness as part of their collective identity, especially when they meet the fans of Beitar Jerusalem. So what happened throughout the years is that the games, the competitions between Beitar Jerusalem and Hapoel Tel Aviv became also a certain competition between a more ethnocentric Israeli collective identity, excluding Arabs, and a more inclusive definition of a civic Israeli national identity that is Israeli, but is inclusive of Arab, Muslim, or Christian citizens of Israel. And many fans, especially the hardcore fans of Hapoel Tel Aviv, see this as an ideological struggle and not only a struggle in the fields of sport.
Daniel, Craig LeMay, a journalist and journalism professor, discusses the degree in his chapter to which Qatar's hosting of a mega event like the World Cup impacts the country's autocratic structures. Are you actually seeing, or is Craig seeing, that the hosting of the 2022 World Cup is leading to a process of political change in Qatar?
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about media and sport in Qatar, of course, all of us are first thinking about BN Sports, network of sports channels. My running gag when working in Lebanon was always I needed, like others, bread and water, because they had the rights for more or less everything. So the German national team, the German league, other major European leagues. So everything I was interested in, I could watch there. But they have expanded to the US, to Australia, to other countries. So BN Sports, of course, is a flagship of Qatar's sporting investments. However, the question Craig is more interested in discussing is whether the World Cup will change norms for freedom of expression. I mean, when it comes to the Press Freedom Index, Qatar is not ranked very well. One of the reasons is a recent banning of the Doha News website. I mean, they are only state-controlled media. And I mean, Al Jazeera, the news channel, is a flagship of Qatar. And it's watched all over the region. And I myself always enjoy it watching. They have a lot of critical reporting on, like, basically anything going on in the region. But what is happening in Qatar? So there is not much of critical reporting about domestic developments in Qatar. So there is a gap in how the channel reports on domestic and foreign affairs. And the argument Craig makes is that he says that Qatari media might change towards more like a critical reporting, but these changes will happen on their own terms. So Qatar will not become a second Norway and, you know, compete with a country like Norway on the first rank in the Press Freedom Index. But there will be some liberations and modernizations, but on their own terms, which take some specific cultural norms into consideration, such as, for example, the emir is not, like, personally criticized.
Mm-hmm. And we should add that even though Qatar internationally is ranked low in freedom of press, regionally it is relatively good. So their point of departure compared to other countries in the region is more promising.
Yes, I mean, if we compare to other Gulf countries, for example, that's certainly true. I mean, I think one, you know, James, if I may add this, I mean, one major issue, I believe, is that there's a lot of criticism on Qatar, and a lot of this might be justified. But one of the reasons for the criticism is also that Qatar is a relatively open country. I mean, it starts with that it's easily able to travel to the country. So with many nationalities, you can just enter the country and obtain the passport as a visa at the airport. So this does not apply to other countries such as Saudi Arabia, for example. And we have like a lot of like international universities there, for example, international research institutions. Qatar gets a lot of attention, but one of the reasons is that it's easily accessible. Lebanon also, for other reasons, gets a lot of like media and scholarly attention because, there are international universities since the late 19th century. People speak English and French and so on. So, some countries get far more attention than others. But one of the reasons is that they're like easier accessible, that there is more of a tradition of like universities and media in foreign languages, etc. And this also explains, even if we look at this edited volume, I mean, some countries are a bit overrepresented compared with others. But it's simply very difficult to access some countries, and it's also very difficult to find authors on some countries, because these countries lack traditions of like instructions at schools and universities in English or French, for example, and it's for researchers more difficult to access them. So I think that's so for future research, it would be nice if we get more case studies on sport in a country like Yemen or Iraq or some of the smaller Gulf countries. There is a lack of scholarship on these countries, and hopefully it will be, we have in the future scholars who manage to do research on these countries, because what is happening now is that there is a bit, it's not proportional anymore if we look at the amount of scholarship on Lebanon or Qatar or also Israel. And then we see that there is hardly anything on countries like Yemen, or Iraq, or Oman, or Bahrain.
Tama, before we start to round up, I want to focus on one chapter that I thought, at least briefly, that I thought was very intriguing, which talked about the way that social media impacts how women athletes brand themselves. And I was wondering whether you could talk briefly about that, but also maybe look at what conclusions one could draw for the broader impact of social media on the relationship on sports and politics and the politics of sports in the Middle East and North Africa.
This chapter by Nida Ahmad, she interviewed and analyzed the discourse of female athletes in certain countries in the region. Now, just to tell you how vulnerable these athletes are, she was very careful even not to mention the countries in some cases, because they are known athletes and they did not want them to be exposed. So we begin with a very fragile and very vulnerable context. And the argument she made in the article is that the way they present themselves is very different from the way women athletes present themselves in an online activity in other countries. So, in what we know about from the research finding that in other contexts in Western cases that the Western sportswomen use social media for self-branding. They share with the audience intimate details about their own life. But Middle Eastern sportswomen who are active online, they are much, much more careful with what they share with their audience. They have in mind a will to promote the image of women's sport, to promote the idea that women can do sports, but everything is really walking on eggs in the Middle East. As much as we show some signs for optimism from women sports activity in some parts of the Middle East, there is still much work to do. We are very far from an ideal situation. And I would like to mention that the work of Nida Ahmed in this chapter corresponds very well with three recent documentary movies about women's sport even more. There are several sport documentaries about women soccer in the Middle East, in Libya, in Sudan, in Jordan, where in every case you see that these athletes are supposed to represent their countries. We're talking about the athletes in the national team of these countries. They have a significant struggle, and I could really watch this movie and imagine the article of Nida Ahmad about these athletes when they present themselves online, how much pressure they have on them. On the one hand, their will to promote their cause. At the same time, they know that there is certain forms of discourse that they cannot measure, certain detail that they better not to expose.
Daniel and Tamer, we could easily go on for another hour, but I fear that we already have passed the 1 hour mark. Before I let you go, perhaps both of you or each of you can describe what's your next project after this book.
All right. So I have become quite interested in issues around sport and nationality. I recently published a paper on naturalization of elite athletes in Qatar and Turkey in comparison. This was a contribution with my Turkish colleague Shem Tinas, who also contributed a chapter to this book. I wrote another article on the Lebanese rugby league national team, which mainly consists of Australians of Lebanese descent. And I just wrote something that's not yet published on stateless athletes in international sport, taking the case of Palestinians in Lebanon. And I have another unpublished paper on eligibility criteria by different sporting federations. So I became pretty interested in issues around sport and nationality. And that's also the path I want to follow in the future. I want to be a little bit careful of announcing now future publications. I just mentioned what was already published or papers that are already under review. But there's certainly more to come in the domain of sport and nationality from me.
I've just published this week, last week, a biography of the Palestinian poet Tawfiq Zayad, who was also a political leader, the mayor of Nazareth. This is a book that takes another angle of the relation between culture and politics. If my previous project dealt with sports, here is a case of someone who was both a poet and a politician. He worked in parallel patterns because his politics, his poetry was revolutionary, was utopic, touched the sublime, aspired to free Palestinians, to bring back the Palestinian refugees, to establish a state based on equality of everyone, to establish a socialist utopia. At the same time, Tawfiq Zayad was a politician, very down to earth. His politics was very pragmatic. And this book goes and analyzes this fine line between this aspiration for utopic liberation and day-to-day pragmatic politics.
Daniel and Tamer, those sound like great projects. I want to thank you both for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Best wishes and take care.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Daniel.